Good day. Today is Thursday, 4th December 2025. And before I start with this programme, just quickly two things. You will notice that I am wearing more formal clothes. This is because in a short time after I finish this programme, I will be meeting with a visitor who's coming to meet me, a member of the European Parliament, and we're going to have a detailed discussion about which more will appear in due course. But for that reason, in light of the person who's coming, I'm dressed more formally today. The second is to remind you once again to tick the like button if, having watched this programme, you decide that you've liked either the programme or that part of the programme that you've chosen to watch and you want to indicate that fact. Now, today we are 2 days away from the meeting between President Putin of Russia and Steve Witkoff and Kushner and Jared Kushner in the Kremlin in Moscow. Kushner and Witkoff travelled directly from Moscow to the United States. There was some expectation that they would stop over somewhere in Europe and would brief Zelensky and the Ukrainians about the meeting which took place in Moscow. But in the event, they flew directly to the United States. The word is that Zelensky is going to travel to Miami, or perhaps, if not Zelensky, some other European officials, some other Ukrainian officials will be traveling to Miami, and they will be meeting Witkoff, perhaps, and possibly Kushner also in Miami again at Witkoff's own private residence, and that is where the Ukrainians will be given the briefing about the discussion with the Russians. So I have to say this, it looks to me as if Witkoff is trying to avoid Zelensky to the extent that he can. I get the same impression with the President of the United States, Donald Trump, who has several times now refused to meet Zelensky over the last couple of weeks. But anyway, the Americans are at least going through the motions of giving the Ukrainians a briefing about the discussions which took place in Moscow. Now, the other party to the discussions, President Putin of Russia, is today flying to India. And this is going to be a massive visit. The word in the Indian media is that Prime Minister Modi is going to Delhi Airport and will be there at the airport to meet Putin, which is an extraordinary act of courtesy, by the way, from one leader to another. And this will be an important visit, and all kinds of trade agreements and deals will no doubt be done. And the Russians are giving indications that they expect relations between themselves and India to move forward to an entirely new level. I will touch a little on this trip of Putin's to India later in this programme, but I expect that my most detailed discussions of it will take place after the meeting has happened, or perhaps as the meeting is underway and we get a better sense of what the two leaders, Putin and Modi, and India and Russia, are agreeing with each other. But anyway, on the eve of this meeting, as Putin often does, he gave an interview to the Indian media, to India Today, to be precise. Now, the Kremlin has not provided us with a transcript because India Today has not yet published the full text of this interview. Obviously, since this is an interview given to an Indian newspaper, the Russians are going to wait for the Indians to publish it first before they publish their own transcript of it. And because India Today is waiting a few hours to publish it so that it comes, presumably its publication is timed with Putin's arrival in India. As of now, I don't have a complete transcript. However, the Russian news agency TASS has provided us with certain excerpts, and I will read what TASS has to say in full. The proposals on a Ukrainian settlement brought by American envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are based on agreements reached during the Russia-US summit in Alaska, Russian President Vladimir Putin noted in an interview with India Today. He noted that Washington proposed breaking a 28-point peace plan drafted by the United States into four separate packages and discussing them that way. So Putin has confirmed that the 28 points, the document with the 27, 28 points that Kushner and Witkoff brought with them to Moscow and which they showed to Putin during the meeting is the original document. There have been other drafts. There's a 19-point draft. There's apparently a 22-point draft. There's a European paper, European counter-proposal. There's apparently yet another fourth document, which we don't know about. But the Americans, interestingly, with the Russians, are still working from the original document, the original 27 or 28-point draft, which the Americans have compiled after discussions with Kirill Dmitriev, and which they've already shown to the Europeans and to the Ukrainians. The Europeans and the Ukrainians have put forward ideas of their own, but the Russians and the Americans are still working from the original document before these new ideas proposed by the Europeans and the Ukrainians were inserted. So it seems to me increasingly as if the meeting between the Europeans, the Ukrainians and the Americans in Geneva was basically a charade. The Ukrainians and the Europeans put forward ideas. They were incorporated in various documents. The Russians have been provided with copies of these documents, but the Americans understand that the Ukrainian and European proposals are totally unacceptable to the Russians, and the Americans are working with a document that they produced before that meeting in Geneva took place. So that's what Putin says. That's what Ushakov said in his briefing to the Russian media, which I discussed in my programs the day before yesterday. And anyway, here we are. So anyway, the day before yesterday. And here we are. Now, Putin then, according to TASS, continued in this way. The meeting with the US envoys, Witkoff and Kushner in the Kremlin, was very useful. It lasted 5 hours as each point should be discussed in detail. Now, Ushakov said that the Russians and the Americans over the course of the Kremlin meeting did not discuss the points in the various drafts. There was no discussion of the wording. Instead, there was a discussion of the essence of the proposals, the points of discussion. Putin is saying something slightly different. He says that each point should be discussed in detail, according to TASS. There is a way of reconciling these two statements, which is that probably what happened is that instead of going through the documents point by point, Putin homed in on certain key issues and explained to the Americans his views and Russia's views and discussed them in the very detailed way that he likes to do. So that probably explains why that meeting went on for 5 hours. Now, it is likely that a lot of other things outside the issue of Ukrainian settlement were discussed. One of the people who was participating in the meeting was Kirill Dmitriev. It's easy to forget that he is the director of Russia's Direct Investment Fund. I suspect, and Ushakov has said, that a very large part of the meeting was devoted to potential future economic and trade cooperation between Russia and the United States. And again, the Russians would have gone through point by point the various things that they can offer in terms of raw materials, technology, industry cooperation in, say, aerospace, who knows what. And the Americans, no doubt, also had their own proposals to make. I would also say that another thing that I suspect Putin wanted to discuss with the Americans, and which I suspect he is particularly concerned to get across to the Americans in the various discussions, is his account, Russia's account, of the military situation. We see that the Ukrainians are still trying to pretend that things are under control. As of the time of making this program, the Ukrainians still allege that they are in control of most of Pokrovsk. The Ukrainians claim that they've recaptured Kupiansk. The Ukrainians claim that they have the situation, militarily speaking, under control. Again, Putin would not be Putin if he didn't want to explain to the Americans that none of this is true, that it is the Russians who are telling the truth about the military situation, and that it is the Russians who are indeed advancing, and that Pokrovsk and Kupiansk have indeed fallen, and that there are indeed Ukrainian troops trapped in Mirnograd, and that the Russians are breaking through in Zaporozhye and in other places, and the towns like Siversk and Guliapolye and perhaps Konstantinovka and Liman as well will also soon shortly fall. So anyway, I suspect that also played a role in extending the discussions. And then, according to TASS, Putin went on to say this: the proposals on a Ukrainian settlement brought by American envoys, Witkoff and Kushner, are based on agreements reached during the Russia-US summit in Alaska. What our US colleagues brought us was based one way or another on our agreements from my meeting with Trump in Alaska, as we discussed these issues at the meeting in Anchorage. Trump is sincerely trying to find a consensus solution to the Ukrainian problem, but this is no easy feat. There were issues during work on the peace plan for Ukraine on which no consensus has been reached. It is difficult work. In some cases, we said, yes, we can discuss this, but we cannot agree to it. So that was what Putin said. There has to be a lot more work on these 28 points before anything remotely approaching an agreement, a draft settlement agreement, can be reached. And as I've discussed in many programs, that's what the Russians have been signaling already for several, well, for over a week now, that this is a good basis for discussion. But it is certainly nothing close to a draft agreement or anything like that. And Putin continued, the 28-point peace plan. Of course, it's not a peace plan, but, you know, draft proposals drafted by the United States is still valid and is being discussed. They just broke these 28 or 27 points into four packages. I wonder why there's a difference in numbers, by the way, 28 points or 27 points. Could it be that that last provision saying that the document is legally binding has been dropped? Because, as I've discussed in previous programs, it's actually meaningless. It has no real significance in a document of this kind, since an international treaty between states is automatically legal and you don't need in the treaty itself to say that. Just guessing. And Putin continues, and they propose discussing these four packages with us, but in effect they are the same points. So there's proposals for some kind of negotiating teams to be set up, and for four working parties, perhaps, to discuss the four different areas of discussion. Anyway, we shall see. And then Putin apparently continued by saying on the issue of the Ukrainian settlement, Moscow proposed that Kiev pull back Ukrainian forces from Donbass, which would have avoided any military confrontation, but Ukraine opted to continue hostilities. We immediately told Ukraine, the Ukrainian troops, the people do not want to live with you. They held a referendum and voted for independence. Withdraw your troops and there will be no military actions. No, they prefer the path of armed confrontation. Now, this is clearly a reference to something that took place on the first day of the special military operation, on the 24th of February 2022, because on that day, a Kremlin official, Dmitry Kozak, telephoned Kiev and apparently spoke to a senior official in Zelensky's government, and I believe that official was Zelensky's chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, but I might be wrong about that. And Kozak said to the Ukrainians, look, if you just withdraw your forces from Donbass, from all the territory of Donbass, there need be no fighting at all. We're not looking to conquer the whole of Ukraine or anything like that. We can then, after you've withdrawn, we can then sit down and we can sort out any remaining issues between us. Now, we know that telephone call took place. The Ukrainians have talked about it in subsequent conversations. They've claimed that Kozak actually demanded Ukraine's capitulation over the course of that call. The Russians have consistently said that all the Russians requested was a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass. I am sure that it is the Russians who are telling the truth. And by the way, and just saying, and if I am right about this, then the fact that this call took place on the 24th of February 2022 utterly refutes the story that you read in many places now that is appearing all over the media in the West, including claimed by some people who are supportive of a settlement and who are obviously acting in good faith, the claim that what the Russians sought to do in February 2022 was to occupy the whole of Ukraine and to take possession of it and effectively either to annex Ukraine in its entirety or to achieve regime change over Ukraine over its government, to overthrow Zelensky's government at that time. The Russian demand on the 24th of February was much more modest. They only sought a withdrawal of Ukrainian troops from Donbass, and as Putin says, had that happened, there would have been no war. And then Putin apparently continued in this interview by saying that Russia will liberate Donbass and Novorossiya either by military or other means. It all boils down to this: either we will liberate these territories by force, or Ukrainian troops will leave these territories and stop fighting there. Europeans need to engage in the work on a Ukrainian settlement, not hinder it. And again, to me, that looks like Putin in effect saying that the entire territory of the four regions, including Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, must be transferred in entire to Russia, including the cities of Kherson and Zaporozhye. The only question is whether this will be done peacefully or by force. It can be done through negotiations. The Ukrainians can agree to withdraw, or it will be done by force. There is no way, however, that it will not happen. And again, these comments of Putin's, if TASS is reporting them correctly, seem to fly against the many reported claims that Putin either offered a ceasefire in Zaporozhye or Kherson regions if the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass, or agreed to an American proposal that there should be a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, provided the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass. It now seems clear to me that both of these suggestions, one of which, the second of which, for a long time I thought might be true, were apparently wrong. The Americans did propose a ceasefire by the Russians in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, provided the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass, but the Russians have never agreed to it. And for the record, the Ukrainians have never agreed to it either, because despite everything, they continue to refuse all suggestions that they withdraw from Donbass, from that part of Donbass that they still control. Now, that brings me to the military situation, because we've now had the first admissions in parts of the Western media that it is the Russian accounts of what is happening that are the correct ones. And the key breakthrough in this respect is a long article that has appeared in the German tabloid Bild Zeitung, which, to say it truthfully, despite being just about the most anti-Russian newspaper in Germany that you can find, and that is against very, very tough competition, by the way, the German media is even more hostile to Russia than the British media is, and that is saying something. Anyway, more hostile overall. But anyway, despite that, Bild Zeitung nonetheless has reported the war more accurately, in my opinion, than almost any other Western publication. And its reporter on the ground, Julian Röpke, is far and away the most realistic Western reporter that I know of on the territory, Western reporter that I know of on the territory of Ukraine. Anyway, Julian Röpke has done something which, as far as I'm aware, none of the other Western journalists in Ukraine has done. And that's that he's established some kind of phone contact or other contact with Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd. And they have told him this. They have said that they are completely cut off, that they are indeed in a cauldron in Mirnograd, exactly as the Russians have been saying. They've also confirmed that the Russians are in complete control of Pokrovsk. And they say that there's about 1,000 of them left, that they want to orders either that they be withdrawn from Mirnograd or that the Ukrainian military break through and supply them properly. They're asking why brigades, which they believe Ukraine still has in reserve, and which are still in the region of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, don't break through and don't create this supply corridor. They complain that the only supplies they are now getting are provided by drones, and that includes food. And they say that this is not enough, not anywhere near enough. And one gets the sense that these troops, and as I said, they say that there are about 1,000 of them left now, that they're becoming cold and that they're short of ammunition and that they're short of food. Now, I read somewhere some rather colourful claims that the troops say that they're starving. This goes beyond what they seem to have told Julian Röpke, or rather Bild Zeitung, but it's pretty awful, nonetheless, that they are indeed trapped, that they feel that they're being abandoned, that they're bewildered and don't understand the decisions of their high command, that they want to be resupplied so that they can stand their ground. If they cannot be resupplied, they want to be extracted, and they seem to have a belief that they can still be extracted, but they are trapped. Now, they are saying some things which do not conform with things that the Russians are saying. The Russian military have told Putin that the reason these Ukrainian troops do not surrender is because they're being threatened by the Ukrainian high command. The Ukrainian high command has supposedly made threats against them or conducted drone attacks against them if they do surrender, and allegedly it has even made threats against their families if they surrender. Well, there's no hint of this from what the Ukrainian soldiers themselves are saying. I get the sense instead that they have been utterly deceived by their own high command about the gravity of their situation. They know that they are trapped. They know that supplies are no longer being provided. They know that they are cut off. They know that Pokrovsk has been lost. But they still have a belief that it is within Ukraine's power to rescue them. And, well, I have to say this doesn't surprise me, because Ukrainian troops would understandably still want to believe what their own high command is saying and would probably refuse to believe what the enemy, in other words, the Russians, is telling them. It reminds me very, very much, by the way, of what happened in 2022 with the Ukrainian troops who got trapped in the Azovstal factory in Mariupol. They were in the various basements and bunkers below the Azovstal factory. They were sending pleading messages by video to the Ukrainian high command in Kiev. They were demanding that the Ukrainian high command extract them. they seem to have no understanding of the extent to which they had actually been completely trapped and cut off. And they were increasingly bewildered by the fact that the Ukrainian high command was not taking the steps to extract them from what was clearly becoming an increasingly intolerable situation. In the end, those Ukrainian troops in the Azovstal factory, which included, by the way, troops from the Azov Brigade, in fact, the Azov Brigade, the one Azov Brigade that existed at that time, they broke and they surrendered to the Russians en masse. We will see whether the same thing happens with the Ukrainian troops who are trapped in Mirnograd. But now there can be no further doubt that the Ukrainians are indeed trapped in Mirnograd and that Pokrovsk is under Russian control. And all of these stories about the Ukrainians being in control of Pokrovsk and recapturing part of Pokrovsk, and all of these videos using AI simulations of Ukrainian soldiers wandering in the center of Pokrovsk, we can see how utterly fantastical, how completely disconnected from reality they actually are. Anyway, that's the situation in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd. The Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd, by their own account, they are at the end of their tether. It can only be a few days now before they either break and surrender or resistance in Mirnograd finally collapses when the Russians move in. Now that will leave the Russians in control of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. The Russians are now saying that they have captured increasing parts of the village of Grishino to the northwest of Pokrovsk. Apparently up to 30 or 40% of Grishino is under Russian control. The Ukrainians continue to resist there, but one wonders for how long. The Russians are pushing north as well. Rodinska looks as if it is under full Russian control. The Russians have recaptured the villages of Sukhetskaya and Novoshakhova, and it looks as if they're gradually closing in on Belitskaya, which is to the west of the area of the Russian breakthrough in August, and that they have recaptured the village of Vladimirovka to the east of the Russian breakthrough area in August. And most reports say that they have also captured Sharkovo, also in the same territory, though as of the time of making of this program, the Russian Defense Ministry has not confirmed that. And the Russians are also said to be fighting in Sofeyevka as well. And the Russians are fighting inside Konstantinovka, the big town to the east of Pokrovsk. And I've already said that it looks as if the Russians control around a third of Konstantinovka, perhaps more of that by now, and that the Russians have advanced both from the east and the west towards the supply lines leading into Konstantinovka from the north, and it looks as if Konstantinovka itself, the garrison there, is soon going to be surrounded. And elsewhere on the battlefronts, we've had reports that the Russians are now indeed fighting inside Liman, and apparently they may be in control of around a third to 40% of that town, and that the Ukrainian garrison in Siversk is also in effect trapped, and the Russians control perhaps half of Siversk. I'm not there. I don't know. But the battle in Siversk is continuing. And there's also been fighting and battles taking place in other places. So the Russians have said that the town of Stepnogorsk, south of the city of Zaporozhye, is now mostly captured. According to Radovka, there is a Ukrainian force still holding out in the administration building, the town administration building, in the center of Stepnogorsk, and in a few buildings, high-rise buildings, located around it in the central square. The Radovka says that the unit, the Russian unit, charged with capturing Stepnogorsk is the 7th Airborne Division, which is, by the way, very, very much an elite Russian division, just saying. Anyway, Radovka says that the Russians have surrounded the Ukrainian troops in this central area of Stepnogorsk. They expect that the Russians will clear Stepnogorsk fairly quickly. Zaporozhye, the city of Zaporozhye, is located 20 kilometers to the north. Once Stepnogorsk falls under Russian control, the Russians will have a secure base from which they can conduct FPV drone attacks on Zaporozhye city itself. They can start, in other words, to attack Ukrainian units inside Zaporozhye city. They can do it with FPV drones. They can do it with multiple types of other drones, the new versions of the Landsat and all kinds of other drones as well. And, well, that will deepen the operational crisis that the Ukrainians face in Zaporozhye. And Stepnogorsk also would enable the Russians to advance eastwards, advancing towards the Ukrainian town of Orekhov, which is now under serious risk of encirclement as well. Now, even as the Russians appear to be completing the battle for Stepnogorsk, the battle for Gulyapolye continues. The Russians apparently are advancing towards a village called Varvarovka, which is located north of Gulyapolye. The key point here is that the Russians are clearing the villages and working towards the capture of Gulyapolye itself. There is a fortified line that the Ukrainians have created, mostly to the north of Gulyapolye. It's apparently about as heavily fortified a line as the Ukrainians have ever created. It has dragon's teeth and barbed wire and apparently mines and trenches. But apparently it is rather narrow. It's a thin defence line. It's not comparable, for example, to the Surovikin line that the Russians created in Zaporozhye to counter Ukraine's offensive, which had massive minefields, far more powerful fortified positions, and which consisted of three heavy defence lines with barbed wire, dragon teeth and all the rest, and which the Ukrainians never even properly reached, except in one small place, and never really seriously had any prospect of breaking through. So this defence line, I mean, well, it is an obstacle, but it is only as good an obstacle as the Ukrainian troops who defend it. And it is quite narrow. And once the Russians break through this defence line, and once they've captured Gulyapolye, it is open ground all the way to Orekhov, and we could see a pincer movement with the Russians advancing from Guliapolye and from the east towards Orekhov, and the Russians advancing from Stepnogorsk from the west towards Orekhov, and the two forces, the two pincers, closing around Orekhov, and then we would get another cauldron. And it's difficult to imagine that Orekhov itself would be able to resist for very long were that to happen. Now, that's the crisis in Zaporozhye, and it continues to get worse. And every hour, every day now, we hear of reports of Russian advances in both of these places. I would add that when it comes to the fortified line, the Russians, of course, now have domination of the skies. Their fighter bombers, their Sukhoi 34 fighter bombers, are very active. And of course, they're able to launch bombs, precision guided bombs, against any Ukrainian defense line. Some of these bombs are enormous. 3,000 kilos, 3-ton bombs, 3 tons of high explosive. Bombs of that kind are specifically designed with the purpose of destroying fortifications, and no doubt the Russians are intending to do that once this front line, once this fortified line is reached, and I have no doubt at all that they will be able fairly quickly, in fact, to break through. So, a critical situation in Zaporozhye, a critical situation in Konstantinovka, Pokrovsk, Mirnograd has fallen, Liman likely to fall soon, Siversk very likely to fall soon. And I discussed yesterday in my program why I believe that the Russians have basically full control of Kupiansk, exactly as Putin says. I don't take seriously Ukrainian claims that they have recaptured any part of Kupiansk. On the contrary, I think the Russians not only are in control there, but exactly as Putin says, they're now currently rounding up the Ukrainian troops out in the fields on the east bank of the Oskol River, shivering and freezing in the cold, probably short of ammunition and food by now, able to put up little resistance. And I suspect that battle will be over very soon. So that brings me back to this basic and fundamental question. Ukraine, its army is withering away. Why, therefore, do they continue to refuse to do the obvious thing, which is withdraw from Donbass? About 2 years ago, after the fall of, after the defeat of Ukraine's summer 2023 counteroffensive, I remember reading an email sent to me by an email correspondent who has a military background. He said that the only sensible thing for the Ukrainians to do, if they're going to preserve their army, is conduct a fighting retreat to the Dnieper and to cross the Dnieper and to accept that all territory east of the Dnieper is effectively lost. Because as time passes, the Russian forces on the eastern side of the Dnieper will become more and more powerful, and the Ukrainians will be able to offer less and less effective resistance. And by keeping most of their army east of the Dnieper, they're making it easier for the Russians to destroy it. And by the way, that brings us back to the fraught topic of the Dnieper bridges. The Russians probably made a decision, a strategic decision, not to destroy the Dnieper bridges, because in their point of view, better that the Ukrainian army crosses the Dnieper, comes to the east bank, fights the Russians there, is comprehensively destroyed, rather than that it retreats intact to the west bank, as it might be persuaded to do if it got the sense that the Dnieper bridges were likely to be destroyed very soon. So why do Zelensky and all of the other Ukrainian officials cling so fervidly to Donbass, even though they are destroying their army by trying to do it? Why do they refuse to withdraw to the Dnieper? Why do they continue this war instead of negotiating seriously for a peace? As Putin says, they were offered back on the 24th of February 2022, and as they have been offered multiple times since. It is actually a very, very good question, and of course there is no simple and satisfactory explanation. The best explanation I can come up with is that it's probably the case that the Ukrainians want the funds to continue to flow from Europe, from the United States. But of course, even those funds are now starting to dwindle. So you might think that that would be a reason to at least rethink now. Or it could be that there is worry that if the war were to end on such catastrophically bad terms, the various people in Kiev, Zelensky and all of the others, would face a terrible reckoning. But they're going to face that reckoning anyway when the inevitable defeat comes. Or it could be that they do indeed live in a world of their own, and that they're in total denial about the realities on the battlefronts. Anyway, one day, no doubt, we will start to get an explanation of all of this. But I am going to suggest that one specific reason why the Ukrainians are clinging on to Donbass, at least, so fanatically, comes back to Zelensky's and the Maidan regime's own insecurities. Because, as has been discussed many times by various media outlets, Zelensky and the regime, the government in Kiev, went through a particularly traumatic and frightening moment in February and March 2022, when the Russian army was encamped around Kiev. It turns out that the size of that army was nowhere near as big as some people thought at the time. It probably numbered at most 20,000 men, nowhere near enough to capture Kiev itself against organized Ukrainian resistance. But nonetheless, I can remember vividly a press conference which Zelensky gave during those days, and it seemed to me that he was almost at breaking point. You could see the stress and the fear, and even some of the Western journalists mentioned the fact at that time. And I think they are haunted by the idea that the Russians will one day come back. And the key thing is that they see Donbass, the fortified line that has been created in Donbass, this line of fortified towns, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Druzhivka, Konstantinovka, Pokrovsk, all of these places, as the wall that is keeping the Russian army away from Kiev. If the Russians don't break this line, if they don't capture Donbass, then their positions in places like Kharkiv region and Zaporozhye and elsewhere are insecure. And as happened, as was demonstrated in early 2022, an advance on Kiev itself becomes problematic unless the Russians work to commit far bigger forces than they have so far shown any willingness to do. But if Donbass is captured, if the fortified lines are broken, if the Russians gain maneuver space, then they can advance, they can roll up all the way to Kiev, and they can place the city under siege, a much tighter siege than the one that happened in 2022, with immeasurably more forces this time. And this time, Kiev itself would become undefendable. Sometimes, occasionally, you get hints, even on the part of the Institute for the Study of War in Washington, which is, of course, the most fervent supporter of Ukraine, you are ever going to find that this is actually the case. So I suspect that this is why the Ukrainians are clinging on to Donbass and are refusing to withdraw from there and are rejecting all proposals, be it from the Russians back in February 2022 or from the Americans today, that they give up Donbass. It's not Donbass that they worry about. It is Kiev. And they worry that if they lose Donbass, Kiev itself will fall. And I think that the Ukrainian government, the current Ukrainian government, perhaps at some level at least, uncertain of its own legitimacy, after all, it does ultimately extend back to the events of February 2014 to explain its existence. And with the best of wills, the events of February 2014 are extremely difficult, I would say impossible, to justify in constitutional and legal terms. And I'm talking now about Ukraine's own constitution and its own laws, which is why, of course, the Russians refer to it as a coup. Anyway, the current government in Ukraine, the Zelensky government, worries that if they have to withdraw from Kiev, if they lose Kiev, if a government, a Russian-backed government, is established there, then its own long-term legitimacy and its right to speak for Ukraine will be put into question. So I think that this is ultimately the explanation for their various motivations. But if one can perhaps come up with some kind of explanation for why the Ukrainians are acting in the way that they are, the behaviour of the Europeans is becoming stranger and stranger and more difficult to understand. And we could see this both in the extraordinary hostility the Europeans are showing towards the American attempts however ineffectual and disorganized they are, to try to come to some kind of, well, freeze, end, settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. The Europeans have opposed every move that the Americans have made. But also, this increasingly bizarre, increasingly strange story, which is the seizure of the Russian assets. There have been now two successive articles in the Financial Times on this topic. The first one spoke about how Ursula von der Leyen has and Kaya Kallas and the European Commission have proposed various plans basically to appropriate these assets to the European Union, to the members of the European Union, the European Council. And now that's been followed up with an even stranger article, which has also appeared in the Financial Times, which, well, the title itself tells its own story. Europe exhausts legal tricks on frozen Russian assets. Now, the first article, I will admit straight away that I found very difficult to understand because it was trying to explain the various ideas that the European Commission was coming up with in order to try to basically gain control of the Russian assets. That article, by the way, reads, Brussels floats emergency powers to raise €210 billion loan from Russian assets. But the article was very garbled, and I got the sense that even the person who wrote it for the Financial Times didn't fully understand what Ursula's actual plan really was. Now, from what I have been able to understand it, Ursula is trying to use emergency powers that the European Commission has, or rather that the European Council has, in a crisis situation, either a crisis dealing with natural events, you know, floods or storms or something like that, to override national vetoes in order to get some kind of big loan package passed to provide funding for Ukraine, a loan package secured on Russian assets. Or she's trying to use these emergency powers to try to reassure the Belgians that if they agree that there should be a €140 billion loan floated, secured on Russian assets, then there is no possibility that those Russian assets will ever be allowed to leave the jurisdiction of the European Union, because doing so would require unanimity within the European Council. Now, I'm not sure, based on these two articles, which of the two it is, and maybe it is both. But what I will say is that in either case, European officials think that this proposal, whatever it is crazy. We've had a European official tell the Financial Times, in the case of the first article, that it's literally a crazy idea and that it violates European law. And, well, we've had, in the second article, more European officials saying the same thing. They say that this makes absolutely no sense. How can such a thing be possibly, or in any way justified? That it's extraordinary. It is extraordinary. It is awfully difficult on a number of legal points. That's one what one said. Another senior European official says, if you ask me if you're driving straight into a wall, then the answer is yes. We told the diplomats a warning that the sheer audacity was a sign that among European capitals, the willingness to fund Ukraine from national coffers is waning after nearly 4 years of war, and the alternative solutions are far from easy to identify. So this is coming out in articles in the Financial Times. European officials, officials of European governments are coming out and they're saying that Ursula von der Leyen and Kaya Kallas and other European Commission officials proposing these various plans to basically misappropriate, steal the Russian assets by floating loans based on them, secured on them, that these plans are, well, crazy, illegal, driving into a wall. They are incredulous about it. And this is not my language. This is not my interpretation of these plans. It is what European politicians, European officials are themselves saying and are saying to the Financial Times. And yet, nonetheless, and despite this, it seems that Ursula and Kaya Kallas and all of the others want to press ahead with these, with this bizarre plan. The point is that you cannot use emergency powers when there is no emergency. It seems to me that if I've understood this correctly, Ursula is saying that you need emergency powers to deal with the emergency of being asked to pay the Russian assets back. I mean, that is absolutely, if true, that is correct, then this is absolutely circular, because you need emergency powers to deal with an emergency, to anticipate, rather, an emergency that you yourself are creating. I mean, that is a legal nonsense. If, as the second article by the Financial Times is suggesting, these emergency powers are anyway emergency powers intended to deal with natural disasters, then there clearly is no natural disaster. And again, using it in this way is clearly wrong. I mean, besides, putting aside the fact that the logic here might be circular, you cannot use law to make something which is illegal legal. It simply cannot be done. Using law in that way is not law, it is anti-law. Any lawyer who has any fundamental understanding of law, any lawyer who has a fundamental understanding of legal principles would understand that, because by definition, law imposes limits on its enforcers and, by the way, on its creators. But it seems to me that what Ursula is trying to do is create a law which does away with those limits. Anyway, this is a grotesque fantasy. To repeat points that I have already made before in previous articles, previous videos, the Belgium government, the European Central Bank, And Euroclear, where all of these funds are held, are all saying that this is unbelievably risky. Bart De Wever, the Belgian Prime Minister, has said that all of these schemes, this whole idea of using the Russian assets in that way, is fundamentally wrong. Now, it was Kaya Kallas, apparently, has had an astonishing meeting with MPs in the European Parliament. And bear in mind, of all of the European institutions, the European Parliament is perhaps the one that is most hostile to Russia. It is actually even more hostile to Russia than the European Commission itself is, and that is saying something. Anyway, Kaya Kallas came along and said to the MPs, we don't need to worry about legality anyway, because what court in Europe on a question like this is ever going to dare to decide against us? And apparently even European parliamentarians were incredulous that she talked in this unbelievably brazen way, basically saying that we can do what we like because we control the courts and there is no possibility, that there is no risk that a legal decision can be made against us which will affect us. Well, as it happens, anyway, she is wrong, because I've done some research on this and I now understand that there is a particular reason why Belgium is so worried about this whole arrangement, because Belgium has in the past made trade agreements with Russia, and these trade agreements incorporate clauses which are, by the way, very common clauses now in trade agreements, which say that when there is a dispute between the parties, an arbitration panel will be set up. That panel does not need to be in Europe. It could be in China, it could be in Brazil, it could be in Singapore, it could be in the United States. I presume it could even be in Russia itself, though that is unlikely. But anyway, it could be set up anywhere in the world. And its decisions on this dispute are binding, and they are not subject to appeal. And they're binding, which means that they're binding under the relevant treaty. And because they're binding under the treaty, they are binding as law in the country that made that treaty, which is in this case Belgium. So if the Belgians consent to the misappropriation of these assets which are located on that territory, the Russians can invoke this clause in the treaty. An arbitration panel can be set up. Will be set up. It will look at, adjudicate, and decide this thing. And, well, it's not difficult to guess what its decision is going to be. Obviously, now, it is going to decide in favour of Russia, if only because the Belgian government, Euroclear, the European Central Bank, and all of these officials who are making all of these comments to the Financial Times have all but said that what Ursula and the Commission are proposing is illegal. And given that this tribunal would be acting on the basis of a commercial treaty, and its decisions are non-appealable and would be binding in Belgium under that treaty, would be law in Belgium. Something else that Ursula is apparently trying to do, which is to try to get European Union legislation which basically annuls the right of a court outside the European Union to make any decision affecting this question on the territory of the European Union. That is also impossible as well, because you cannot use law to basically extinguish commercial legal rights in that way. Again, that is well known. It is anti-law to do it. It would be actually an act of anti-law to do it. And of course, in theory, you can, if you simply say straightforwardly that a treaty with Russia no longer has effect and any tribunal set up under that treaty no longer has legal effect in that sort of way. Well, of course you can do that. But then your credibility is absolutely shot to pieces. From that moment on, it is all but inconceivable that anybody is going to take you seriously outside the European Union anymore. And, well, at that point, I have to say, I can't imagine countries around the world placing their money in European institutions in the same way, because they could say, well, the European Union, the European governments are prepared to simply abolish law and seize our assets and do all of these things as they choose and as they wish. There is, again, one of the officials who has spoken out against this to the Financial Times. He's actually made that very point. He's pointed out that doing something like this, well, I will read the point. Some officials fear the workaround will contravene EU law. One official said the strategy was crazy and added that there was clearly not an economic emergency in the internal market that could justify it. And another official said that doing something like this will destroy the EU's reputation as an entity that basically observes law. That at that point, the EU's reputation as a law-based institution will be shot to pieces, not just within Europe, but globally as well. Anyway, there it is. Despite all of that, despite all of this criticism, the European Commission is insisting on this. So is Chancellor Merz. He's coming to Belgium to meet with Belgian Prime Minister Bart De Wever. He wants to have dinner with Bart De Wever, and he's inviting Ursula to join the dinner. So it'll be two of them against one over dinner. You can imagine what it'll be like, even as they sort of try and tuck in and enjoy their food. You will find the pressure coming from Ursula and from Merz to go along with this thing. This thing which European officials are saying is crazy and which is going to have this catastrophic effect on the way forward, on the credibility of the European Union going forward. Why are they doing it? They're going to give money, 140 billion euros of money, to Ukraine, which is losing the war and is going to lose the war. They are going to give money to a country that is unbelievably corrupt and which is going through a massive corruption scandal, which has resulted in the second most powerful man in Ukraine losing his job, and with an order being made in Ukraine, that that man is no longer allowed to leave the country. They're going to go on and do all of this. For what? Now, my colleague and friend, Alex Christoforou, has at various times suggested that the real purpose of these extraordinary schemes that the European Union is coming up with, that the real purpose is not so much to help Ukraine itself as to cover European governments and European institutions for the fact that they have already helped themselves to Russian assets in order to fund Ukraine, assets which presumably are held outside Euroclear. So that this is the real purpose behind this operation. And given the fact that seizing assets and misusing them in that kind of way would be clearly illegal, I can absolutely see the logic of that. But bear in mind that doing something like this in order to cover the already happened theft of assets, assuming it has taken place, simply spreads and compounds the illegality. It would be another step, in effect, further admitting the extraordinary illegality of what has already happened. There is that British expression, if you are in a hole, stop digging. And this, it seems to me, simply digs an even deeper hole. I can't help but feel that ultimately there is an element of obsession about this. A pathological loathing of Russia, an inability to give up on Project Ukraine, even as it collapses, probably a loathing of Donald Trump as well, and a desire to spite him by prolonging the war and making the whole Trump peace initiative, such as it is, even more complicated than it already is, and that ultimately it's anger and hatred and a sense of obsession that is driving all of this. From hell's heart I stab at thee, for hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee. What other explanation is there for this? Now, at that point, if I'm right about that, then rational explanations, attempts to try and explain this logically, no longer apply. We are no longer in the world of diplomacy and geopolitics and international affairs, let alone diplomacy. We are in the world of psychiatry. How else to describe it? But anyway, that's where we are. And to repeat again, I am not the person who's coming up with words like crazy to describe these schemes. European officials are, and they're doing that in interviews that they're giving, admittedly anonymously, to the Financial Times. They're not saying it to me. Perhaps they're not saying it on the record, but they're saying it, and clearly that's what they think. And given the stakes, I think they should come out into the open and say it publicly too. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and our new Substack site, where, by the way, I'm also penning articles. You can also support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.